You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Across the U.S., states are trying to change the way their parole systems work in an effort to lower recidivism rates and reduce prison populations. But around one half of all the inmates put on parole end up violating the terms of their release and are sent back to prison. In a collaboration between Frontline and the New York Times called Life on Parole, a documentary film, documentary filmmaker Matthew O'Neill and New York Times criminal justice editor Shyla Dewan take a look at how it's working in Connecticut. The film airs tomorrow at 10 p.m. on PBS stations. It's already available online, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Matthew O'Neill and Shyla Dewan to our show. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Charlie, you have a front page story in today's Times called She's His Rock, But on Parole He Can't See Her. Is there anything new in that article that wasn't covered in the film?
Well, I think we just wanted to take a closer look at the story of one parolee of the several that the film focuses on, and it gave us a chance to look at the specifics of his case maybe a little more in depth. And the main thing there was looking at the fact that when you get out of prison, but you're still on parole, you're really not free. It's not liberty. There's many kinds of constraints that can be placed on you.
And people aren't aware of just how many strings are attached. What about the parolees? Are they surprised?
I think that when you get out on parole, you've been looking forward to this date, getting out of prison for months or in some cases years and years. And then to get out and realize that you're, quote, free, but not really free at all. You have to live under all these restrictions. Even though they signed on to the restrictions, there's a lack of awareness of how that's actually going to play out in their lives.
In some cases, it's not seeing certain people. In other cases, they're living in halfway houses that have very strict rules.
Yeah, some of the restrictions can seem quite sensible, like not visiting the premises of a location that you burglarized, or you know, not using illegal drugs. But how do you tell a 24-year-old not to drink alcohol ever, or give someone who's paying for their own apartment a curfew? There are these restrictions that don't feel natural to many of the people who are trying to live on parole.
You followed four people for a year and a half, people who were put on parole in Connecticut. How did you wind up picking these four?
We went through quite an extensive process of meeting people inside the prisons. You know, one of the interesting things about what's happening in Connecticut right now amidst these reforms is a commitment to transparency. And this is one of the first times that they invited filmmakers and journalists really into the system in this way to go so deep. And so we met maybe, what, about 120 or so different people behind the walls to talk to them before they were released, to understand what their expectations were and see if they'd want to participate.
And they had to really allow a few to film a lot of private moments.
And I think that's another point when you're talking about the constrictions of parole, is that it affects not just the parolee, but their whole family and friends. And in the case of today's article, Errol and his fiancée was very deeply affected because her whole life was turned upside down.
Should we talk about them first? First of all, I wonder, is the Connecticut situation typical? Are other states who are trying to do something similar functioning in very much the same way?
Do you mean in terms of the changes that Connecticut has tried to make?
If you had filmed in California, for example, would the stories have been fairly similar?
I mean, I think there's 50 different justice systems in this country, so it's hard to say exactly how much similarity there is, but a fair amount of overlap. I think it's a pretty constant theme that states that want to make changes are looking at which of these restrictions on parolees make sense and which, in essence, simply give them more rules to break or set them up to fail, putting so much restrictions on someone that they're sort of bound to violate in some way.
And do they feel that they're set up to fail?
I think you hear over and over in the film, people say, oh, I wish I could just go back to jail. Jail was so much easier. Prison was so much easier, which seems like so difficult for us to understand.
One of them, in fact, even says that he commits crimes so he can go back to jail because he knows how to function while there.
jail's awful, but you do get three meals a day, and you know where you're going to wake up, and you know where you're going to go to sleep. And for a lot of these people coming out on parole, functioning in the world that we're all struggling through is really difficult.
I mean, imagine getting out of prison and being told you can't go into a place that serves alcohol, or you can't talk to another person who's on parole. I mean, in some ways, like, how do you even know? Mm-hmm. You can't walk into a convenience store because they sell beer.
But in some cases, the other person on parole is one of your only friends.
Or that too. One of the people actually said that. She said, these are the people that I'm seeing every day. I'm going to these meetings and classes, and they're full of other people like me.
Right.
Let's talk about the parolee that's the subject of your article today, Errol Brantley. What crime had he committed?
He had a long rap sheet, but and his situation is very complicated because it's like he's on probation for one thing and then he does this other thing. But ultimately, in this instance, he was in prison for a break-in of an auto shop that he broke into at a time when he was using heroin, homeless, needing money to fuel his habit.
And he completed a drug program while in prison.
Yes.
Pretty much all of them come out clean.
I think you almost have no choice but to come out clean. In Errol's case, you know, Errol would often talk about how, sure, you can score drugs in prison, but he functioned at his best to a certain degree when he was in prison because he's trying so hard to get out and trying so hard to get back to the people that he loves.
When he was released from prison, one of the stipulations was that he wasn't allowed to see his girlfriend, Catherine, because he had robbed her at one point.
Yes. I mean, the story is that a couple of years before, Errol was, you know, had relapsed, needed money for a fix, came home, took the television, took her car, pawned the television, and she really wanted him to get help, to go to rehab, and he wouldn't. She called the police, and that sort of made her officially, according to the system, a victim.
And you can't have any contact with a former victim. But even if she was his girlfriend.
That's the case. And as one of the parole officers say, in some cases, he has parolees that can't have contact with their kids because they're considered victims.
Now, Errol's been in and out of jail 11 times. Is he a good candidate for parole, given his high recidivism rate?
It's a good question. You know, what makes a good candidate for parole? It really begs the question, like, what is the function of parole in our society? Is it to reintegrate people into our society and make them tax-paying citizens? Is it to empty the prisons and get them off the prison rolls? And I think Errol's case is an especially confounding one because for the last 20 years, he's been in and out and in and out of all sorts of different programs. And I think he would probably say that, you know, there's not a drug program in the state of Connecticut that he hasn't visited. I think he did say that to me once.
And I think there's sort of also no algorithm, there's no formula that exactly tells you who's a good candidate and who's not, even given whatever their past might be. They may have a lengthy rap sheet and still be a good candidate for parole. And there's a movement in criminal justice more and more towards using these risk assessments where they try to give you a bunch of questions and see if you're a good risk. And they're not great.
But if he can't go to live with Catherine, where can he go?
In this case, he went out and he lived with his mother, and that was where he started out, because they wouldn't approve his girlfriend's residence where he had been living before he was arrested.
My guests are Matt O'Neill and Shyla Dewan. They have collaborated on a film for PBS's Frontline called A Life on Parole. It will air tomorrow at 10 p.m. on PBS stations, already available online. Matt, is this an odd film for you to be doing? Because pretty much all the other films you've made have taken you outside of the country.
Yeah, well, this is
Baghdad, China.
You know, we have lots of
is
really
Connecticut
important
a
things.
Foreign country.
In some ways. I think we have a lot of things that we need to address right here at home. And if you look at our incarceration system and the criminal justice system, I would say that with the opioid crisis is one of the most pressing problems that we as a society have to deal with. because we have a lot of people who are incarcerated and being taken out of society. The effects are intergenerational and resonate over and over again. And if we don't find a productive way to like shape our society so it deals with this problem, it's going to haunt us.
One of the things we found was that many, many of the subjects had really traumatic experiences in their early childhood. And then you have to ask, well, if you have that and that correlates to a higher levels of involvement with the criminal justice system. So if it starts so young at a time when it's not really the person making choices, but things are happening to them, and then you start to see this cycle.
And drug abuse is always a difficult thing to get past. Many people who go into rehab wind up going back to the drugs because that's the life they know, or because it's already in their body chemistry.
I think it's a chemistry thing, and it can be an overriding desire. Even listening to Errol describe it, or even other people with addiction, that you know, when you want it, you will climb over your grandmother's dead body. Sort of. I mean, I think Errol said to me at one point when I said, "How were you feeling in that moment when you were with Catherine before she called the police?" And he said, "There is no feeling. There's only heroin."
But he's not in jail because he's a heroin abuser. He's in jail because he commits crimes to pay for his heroin habit. Was that the case with all of these people, who were the ones that you saw who had an opioid problem?
So in terms, two of the people that we followed had an opioid problem that are featured in the film. But I think overwhelmingly, the number in Connecticut's prison system is more than 85% of people who are incarcerated have a substance abuse issue.
Men.
Yeah, sorry, of men who are incarcerated have a substance abuse issue. And that shows that to a certain degree, our criminal justice system is the addiction counselor of last resort for many, many, many people.
I think, Matt, at one point, Frontline said to you, are you doing a story about life after prison, or are you doing a story about a film about addiction?
Because addiction and drugs are so intertwined with everyone's story.
Yeah, it was impossible to separate them out, and several of our related articles are about addiction as well.
How long is the average prisoner out on parole? Is there a time limit?
That's a good question. I mean, it's a mixture of different times. And you see in the film, I think Vaughn has almost 7 years of parole, and that parole is actually part of his sentence. It's not an early release mechanism. Other people have as little as 2 months on parole.
And some states have been trying to change that so that, you know, if you do well for a certain period of time, you can be released from that. Because 7 years on parole, 7 years where you are beholden to rules that the rest of the people around you in society are not beholden to, can be quite a long time, depending on what you did.
That's right. Shyla was on time here at the studio, but I was 5 minutes late. So my parole could have been violated today, Leonard.
Well, we're going to have to send you back and to behind the camera somewhere. You interviewed parole officers as well. Errol's parole officer was Mac Pavlovich. What was his view of Errol's chances of staying out of jail?
I mean, talking to the parole officers is really interesting because they've seen everything. They're so skeptical. They have seen probably the most surprising people screw up and do bad things on parole. So they come at it from that perspective. So they would say things like, yeah, I mean, does Errol have hope? Yeah, he has hope. I mean, if I didn't have a hope pile to put some of my parolees in, I would have to change jobs. But you know, that view is very, very tempered by, I think, the reality of their experience.
My guests are Shyla Dewan, who is the New York Times National Criminal Justice Editor, and documentary filmmaker Matt O'Neill. They have collaborated on a documentary called Life on Parole, which will be broadcast on PBS stations as part of the Frontline series tomorrow night at 10 o'clock. You can also find it online, and we have information about all of that on our show page at WMIC.org. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with filmmaker Matt O'Neill and with New York Times criminal justice editor Shyla Dewan. We're talking about their collaboration on a film called Life on Parole, which will be airing tomorrow at 10 p.m. on PBS stations. It's also available online. And you can also find it at nytimes.com/parole, along with a series of articles that Shyla has written in connection to this story. Let's talk about some of the other people who you cover. Jessica Proctor was just 10 days out from being released when you spoke to her. What had she done to wind up in jail?
Oh, well, Jessica's a fascinating story because when you look at her crime on paper, it is really, really scary. I mean, the other girl had 250 stitches after the fight with a razor blade, and Jessica did almost 10 years. I think it was 8.5 of her 10-year sentence.
What had led her to cut the girl?
In Jessica's retelling, she was jumped and she was defending herself. At the time, she was a drug dealer and addicted to PCP and a teenager, 18 years old. She had a 4-year-old child. When you think about that living situation, what she was managing at that time, she then came of age in prison.
So she had a kid when she was very young, and that kid has lived without her for many years.
Yes.
And that's just another story you tell here about the family that was left behind in many cases. Well, in the case of this son, it was a son, right?
Yes, Dante.
He barely knows his mother.
They talked on the phone for years. And when I first...
Could he visit her in prison?
It's very difficult because the prison was in the southern part of Connecticut and they were in a city and did not have easy access to transportation or, you know, the bus fare. So he, I think, only saw her once when he was like 3 years old. They talked often on the phone, but I think it was a struggle in their relationship when she actually got out because she had been just an idea to him and all of a sudden it was real.
But doesn't that also motivate somebody to live by the rules of parole if she wants to reconnect with her family?
I think that the carrot of a family and a happy lifestyle is the best motivator you can possibly have. And all the different stories that we followed 10 different people over the course of almost 2 years, the people who had a strong family base tended to do the best.
Did you think about why some people don't go back on drugs while others do? Is there some reason that some people are able not to go back?
Yeah, how you unpack addiction is so personal. I mean, you have to go so deep into the head of the individual to understand it. I think, I'm trying to go through in my mind, almost everybody stumbled at some point. But when's drug use drug use, and when is it addiction? When is having a drink alcoholism, or a kid having a beer?
And then, of course, there's just the resistance to somebody telling you what to do. In one case, one of the parolees seems to not respect his parole officer very much. She's just a beginner.
But a lot of these people are very young. I mean, that's not true of Errol, but, you know, especially younger people are chafing more against the restrictions and having a harder time following them. But even in Errol's case, you saw him come out and it's just like it didn't even sink in when they said, you cannot see Catherine, you cannot text her, you cannot call her. It's like, oh, he was like, okay, and he went straight to her house.
Well, he got into a car with her when he left prison. He broke the rules of his parole almost immediately. Tell us about Vaughn Gresham. What was he in jail for?
The way Vaughn told me the story of his crime was that he said, you know, growing up, I didn't have an ATM card or parents to give me money, so we'd call the pizza delivery guy and rob him. And that was what he was in jail for.
So he saw it as just a matter of survival?
Survival or access to cash. You know, I don't want to glorify it in some way. What he was doing was absolutely wrong. But when Vaughn speaks in the film, you see a perspective that is certainly like very foreign to mine. Vaughn grew up with nothing. And to a certain degree, the crimes that he committed were ones of want. I don't know if in his heart of hearts he's truly repentant. You know, only he knows that. But I think he's trying to find a new way to navigate the world.
He's been out on parole before and sent back to prison.
He's been back and forth a couple of times. And I think he's out right now. It's been the longest that he's been out on parole. He's having trouble finding a job this time round. And so we'll see how he does.
That's part of the problem, that they have to try to get a job. And it's not so easy to get a job if you've spent a fair amount of time in prison. Aren't there programs?
There are programs, as you see, or as we saw, people would often get very marginal jobs. Like one guy was working in a mattress recycling center, if you can imagine, just ripping apart used mattresses all day. That was his job. And there were certain businesses we discovered that were much more apt to hire people with a criminal record. But it's notoriously hard to get a job. I mean, it's just one strike against you that makes it so much easier for the employer to hire the next person. Another thing that happened was that if you were in a halfway house and you had a job, you would go to your job, but the halfway house would call your boss and say, you know, is he here? Did he show up? What time is he supposed to leave? And that just gets, even if your boss wants to keep you, that gets pretty, becomes an obstacle to maintaining that employment.
So, there's this part of the problem is a lack of sensitivity on the part of the state?
I don't know if it's just on part of the state. I think it's on all of us. It's on society as well. Is it trying to understand that that black mark, that felony conviction, it follows them forever. If we don't open up our minds to consider how they might contribute as a member of society, an active member of society, they're going to be relegated to life in prison and on parole.
There's a notion, I see it a lot in the responses to the articles we publish, that that there's sort of a never-ending debt that the criminal must pay. You can never serve your punishment and be done with it. And that's part of this idea that your record follows you throughout all of these things. It affects whether you can even volunteer at your child's school.
But isn't the idea of a penitentiary penitence and then paying off your debt to society now? Shouldn't you come out with a clean slate? I mean, I'm just being theoretical.
Right, but this idea in American life in particular is very, I think it's a difficult one. I think there many people, I mean, criminals are the other, right? That's not me. And so just punish them permanently. Well, you forfeit, the view I see being expressed is you forfeit your rights permanently when you break the law.
Although it was hard for me to feel a lot of sympathy to some of these people. They had a chip on their shoulder. They were angry. They were they were not people I wanted to hang out with.
Probably not people you wanted to hang out with, but people. People who can improve themselves and can, you know, it can be improved if we try. And I think that's the real challenge, is that if your crime haunts you forever and chases you around, if you're forever defined by that crime, well, what are you going to be able to accomplish? How do you overcome that?
Of wanting to hang out with them or not, also keep in mind, we gave some of them a 10-question quiz called the ACE quiz, which is measures your childhood trauma on a scale of 1 to 10. And 4 is considered a high score on that quiz. And it was developed for Kaiser, and it correlates with all kinds of health problems and low educational attainment and bad outcomes in general. And the people we gave it to were scoring 9s. 8s, very high levels of, you know, witnessing abuse, violence,
childhood trauma,
experiencing abuse. So we're not giving them the means in childhood to then make decisions that you and I would go, oh yeah, that was a good decision, or to have an attitude that you and I would say, oh yeah, that's a good attitude. I'm not saying it's not possible, but the deck is definitely stacked against them.
My guests are Shyla Dewan, the New York Times National Criminal Justice Editor, and filmmaker Matthew O'Neill. They've collaborated on Life on Parole, which will premiere on PBS stations at 10 p.m. tomorrow, also available online and through nytimes.com/parole. This is WNYC, wnyc.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The fourth person you follow is Rob Sullivan. What's he in jail for?
This most recent charge was, I believe, an assault, right? With Rob's record, it chases him for so many years that there's almost nothing that he hasn't been charged with. And I think you see in Rob's story someone who has been institutionalized to a certain degree. He's the one that most often claims that he's been, that he finds it easier to survive in jail than he does on the outside.
Because that's the life he's known best.
It's the life he's known since he was 19 years old. What breaks my heart about Rob's story is not necessarily Rob himself, but the way it's played out in his family and the way it plays out in the life of his daughter, Rayanne, because you see the real love between a daughter and her father. And I think at times he tries to do the right thing. But I'm fearful that so much of Rayanne's life will be defined by what her father has done.
Do we know how many of the 5,000 parolees in Connecticut violate the terms of their parole?
Some of the numbers are very tricky to get. I wish I had those handy at my
somewhere around a third, I think.
It's around a third, but you understand there's now, so Connecticut has, it used to be that if you failed a drug test for cocaine, they just send you right back to prison. Now they have what they call graduated sanctions, which means sending you back to prison is not the first thing they do. So there's levels, like there's misconducts before there are violations and suspension of parole.
You spoke with Catherine Montoya, who helped create a special unit that tries to support female parolees with things like childcare. She was assigned to Jessica Proctor. How long was Jessica's parole?
I believe that Jessica's going to be with her for almost 5 years. And it's one of the things that Officer Montoya talks about a lot, is that when she gets someone who's going to be with her for a long period of time, she really studies the history of that individual and tries to understand how best to help them. She referred to Jessica, and this is something that was eye-opening for me, as a victim. And she said that it helped her understand Jessica's point of view, having a baby at 13, getting pregnant at 12, and picturing her as a victim, not just as someone who committed a crime, enabled her to constructively guide her.
You spoke to Kelly, Rob Sullivan's wife. She says that his being in prison has been a big part of their daughter Rayanne's life. Does Kelly believe that Rob can stay clean and out of jail? One of the things that she seems to want most is that he get rid of these teardrops that he's had tattooed on his face.
If anyone you loved had teardrops tattooed on their face, wouldn't you want them gone?
He owes $100,000 in child support. Does anybody expect him to be able to pay that? He's been in prison.
It's a good question. When you see these child support bills and the number of people who are incarcerated that owe child support, well, if I came out of prison with a $100,000 debt hanging around my neck, I'd be hard-pressed to figure out, you know, what step one is, because it would seem almost hopeless.
Child support debt can, until very recently, could accrue while you were in prison, because it was considered by many states to be voluntary unemployment, which meant, well, you still owe that money. And only recently have there been some changes made in that area.
You also spoke with Vaughn Gresham's parole officer, Lisa Brayfield. How many parolees does she supervise?
At that point in time, she was responsible for 2 halfway houses, and with
even
more than
100
men.
Even though she was pretty new to the job,
she was new to the job, the parole officer's job is a very, very difficult job when you look right at it. You know, they're not just law enforcement agents; they're also called on to be drug counselors and social workers, and for a relatively young woman interacting with this big population, I think it's quite challenging.
He was going to move out of his halfway house into an apartment, but his parole officer decided he was in violation of the terms of the parole. What had he done?
In that case, he had left an educational program that he was attending voluntarily, but it was an educational program that he had signed up for and told the house that was where he would be. He left that educational program early and went and visited what he considered his home. I believe it was his sister's home, and was unaccounted for some hours in the community. And that's a parole violation.
A listener asked, isn't OJ up for parole this Thursday?
I think I read that their ESPN is doing it like live coverage of his parole hearing, believe it or not.
I just was passing through. I decided not to stay with a show in which they were conjecturing on whether he would return to his old ways of partying, or whether he would have been sobered by his experiences in prison if he gets out on parole.
That actually raises an interesting point. I think that we hear so much about mass incarceration, and you know, the U.S. has by far the highest rate of incarceration and long sentences. And I think one of the surprising things that Matt said to me when I would do a periodic check-in with him about his takeaways on the project, he said, you know, the people who have served the longer sentences are doing better. than the people who serve short sentences.
And when we asked the parole officers about that too, they said the same thing, that the long prison sentences tend to lead to people who are much more compliant, in part because they've been institutionalized and in part because it's just been so long since they've been outside.
And in part because of age. You do
Correct.
Age out of wanting to commit more crimes. But, I mean, this raises a really interesting policy question, which does that mean that everyone who does something wrong should go in for a long time? I don't think so. I don't think that's what we really want to see, but maybe it means that shorter prison sentences shouldn't be used at all.
Human Rights Watch published a study in which they decided that people who are past a certain age are very unlikely to commit a crime. And
right.
even if they're in for six lifetimes without parole, they are safe to release, whereas some of the other young ones might not be. One thing that most of the parolees you followed agreed on was that they were over-supervised and felt oppressed. Do you think they had a valid beef there?
Well, when it comes to their feeling, I would find parole quite oppressing. What's interesting when it comes to over-supervision, and this is something that the commissioner of the Department of Corrections made a point of saying, is that over-supervision leads to more failure and more violations, because the closer you're looking, the more things you're going to find as a parole officer. And I think part of the changing attitude towards parole is away from this catch them and put them back in prison, and towards what can we do to help them reintegrate? What's our role in helping them reintegrate?
And mm-hmm. a lot of times when they're put back in prison, it's not because there was a new crime perpetrated on society. It's because they had a beer or they shot up heroin. And I mean, that is a crime, but it's not a crime that has a big impact broadly.
And you see that play out in the stories as well. I think that Officer Paulich with Errol, at times it feels tough and oppressive, that, certainly from Errol's point of view. But from Officer Paulich's point of view, we're talking about a guy who used heroin multiple times and was dishonest about it. And I think that's the real difficulty in that relationship between a parole officer and a parolee, is that they're often looking right past each other. They can't see the world from the other person's perspective. And it leads to a fundamental dishonest dialogue, because the people who are on parole are so fearful of all these restrictions and what these restrictions could mean in their life that they start lying from basically day one.
Documentary filmmaker Matthew O'Neill and New York Times criminal justice editor Shyla Dewan have collaborated on a Frontline film called Life on Parole. It premieres tomorrow night at 10 on PBS stations. It's already available online and at nytimes.com/parole. Thank you both so much for being on our show.
Thanks for having us,
Thank
Leonard.
Thank you.